You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 7th of May 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House here on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Tom Burgess-Watson, and Hugo MacDonald.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, as Mohamed Morsi heads to Brazil, we'll ask if Egypt and Brazil might ever be economic bedfellows.
And we'll follow the flight of the bumblebee with the author of a new book called Sting in the Tail.
You think of all the fruit and veg, blueberries, strawberries, runner beans, field beans, peas, courgettes, tomatoes, all the really nice stuff that when you sit down for a meal, the stuff that makes it tasty, is pretty much all pollinated by bees.
Xenia Dormandy from Chatham House will take us through the stories to follow in the next 24 hours.
And in the back streets of Hong Kong, we visit the city's most celebrated tattoo artist. That's in today's look at the island's cultural scene.
The space is same important in the drawing. So you have a breathing space. When you look at the body, you don't feel so tight. The tattoo just like come from your body. It's like part of your body. It's not like a cover your body.
All that, plus we'll squeeze in a song hopefully too. That's all to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
But before all that, let's get a wrap of the world news with Barney Burnham.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. Three women who'd been missing for 9, 10 and 13 years respectively have been found alive and well in a house in Ohio. They're believed to have been abducted as teenagers and were found near where they were last seen in Cleveland. They were rescued after neighbours heard screaming. One of those neighbours, Charles Ramsey, spoke to local TV station WKYC.
I hear the screaming. So I see one of my neighbours across the street leave his house and run toward my house. But he doesn't come to my house. He goes next door. So I go to the door to see what he's looking at. And this girl is kicking the door and screaming. So I go over there with my Big Mac and I say, well, can I help you? What's going on? She says, I've been kidnapped and I've been in this house a long time. I want to leave right now.
The women have been taken to hospital and are reported to be in good health. At least one of them is reported to have had a baby. They've been named as Gina De Jesus, Amanda Berry and Michelle Knight. Cleveland Deputy Police Chief Ed Tomba says arrests have been made.
There's three in custody. They're all brothers.
Did they live in the house?
And one of them lived in the house and the other hit. Well, one of them had on his driver's license was the Seymour address, and the other two had addresses on the Lower West Side.
North Korea has begun moving missiles away from a launch site on the country's east coast, according to a US official. The unnamed official says the Musudan missiles have been ready for launching at any moment, but have now been moved. Pyongyang had reportedly been preparing for a missile launch last month after a series of threats to target South Korea, Japan and US bases in the Pacific. The latest moves being seen as the first sign of an easing of tension on the Korean Peninsula. But a senior official from the US National Security Council said it would be premature to celebrate, given North Korea's unpredictable behaviour. Syria's opposition national coordination body has condemned the Israeli raids on Damascus suburbs and accused Israel of using Syria's internal conflict for its own political ends. The Syrian opposition group said it wouldn't tolerate any aggression from Israel on its territory and called on the international community to pressure Tel Aviv against further strikes. Israel insists the attacks were nothing to do with the Syrian conflict and were targeting Iranian missiles which are on their way to Hezbollah militants. A spokesman said there were no winds of war. The World Health Organization is warning that outbreaks of measles are threatening Europe's commitment to eliminate the disease by 2015. The WHO says levels of vaccination in rich Western countries are too low, and catch-up campaigns like the one launched in Britain are needed across the continent. The WHO's European region covers 53 countries who've vowed to stop the disease spreading. But there are high levels of it in the UK, Turkey, Ukraine and Romania, while France and Italy have both had outbreaks in recent years. The Democratic Republic of Congo is the toughest place on earth to be a mother and newborn baby, according to a new report by the charity Save the Children. The State of the World's Mothers 2013 report ranks countries of the world by how safe they are for mothers and their newborns. Ishbel Matheson from the charity.
If you're a mum in Finland, you're right at the top of the ranking. You have great education, you've got good chances of income, you've got a really low risk of dying in childbirth and very high chances of your child surviving. If you're in the Democratic Republic of Congo, the toughest place in the world, all of that is reversed. You've got a very high chance of dying in childbirth and very low rates of education for women. So those are the two extremes in the ranking.
Two bottles of Scotch whisky recovered from a shipwreck which inspired the novel and film Whisky Galore have sold in an online auction in Glasgow for £12,050. They are among eight bottles rescued from the wreck of the SS Politician in 1987. The Politician ran aground off the island of Eriskay in the Outer Hebrides in 1941. It was carrying 28,000 cases of whisky to Jamaica. Islanders recovered hundreds of bottles and hid them from customs officers, inspiring Compton Mackenzie's novel, which became a classic British film comedy. The auction bottles are thought to be unfit for human consumption. Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Barney. It's 8:06 here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
And you're listening to Midori House. It's 6 minutes past four in the afternoon in Tokyo, 6 minutes past eight in the morning here in London.
And we start the show with the agenda setter today. Zainia Dormandy, Senior Fellow at Chatham House, will take us through the stories we need to know in the following 24 hours. Welcome to the show, Zainia.
Always a pleasure.
Now, let's start in Pakistan, which obviously big elections.
Yeah, this is actually kind of surprising. I'm surprised that everybody isn't totally transfixed on this story, although maybe that's just me. Of course, next Saturday, the Pakistanis have their elections. What is profound this time around is this will be the first time in Pakistan that the elections have gone from one democratically elected government full term to another democratically elected government. A lot of people kind of tend to focus on, yeah, but we've still got the same factors, we've still got the same people. It's the PPP, led by Zardari, the current government, with the opposition PMLN, led by Nawaz Sharif. He's been prime minister before. He's almost certainly going to win. You know, you're just going to get the same government, same people, same corruption, same incompetence, etc., etc. On the other hand, A, this is a real marker for democracy and change. And B, I haven't been back in Pakistan since December, but the level of hope amongst the Pakistanis about this change, about the fact that they've got to the point where this can happen, is unbelievable. The narrative here is all about violence. You look at the papers, you will have seen today yet another attack on during a rally, political rally near the Afghan border, I think 20 people dead. And this is the narrative that we see here in the West. We constantly see which attack, who, what, where, when. In Pakistan, it's about our country is transforming with incredible levels of hope, incredible levels of possibility, which I just think is fascinating. But the fact that we don't seem to be tuning into that.
No, it's good to hear you say that because, you know, we talk about Pakistan the whole time in the news. And as you said, it looks such a bleak picture. And yet, amidst all of that hope and that optimism, there's a couple of wild cards, aren't there, in the mix. Tell us a little bit about them.
So essentially there's, and I'm simplifying this, but there's essentially three parties that we're really watching in a significant way. There's the current government, well, caretaker, but the one that's been leading for the last 5 years, the PPP, led by Zardari, that is completely, the polls are showing that is completely destroyed. I mean, it's 5 years of mismanagement, effectively, and they don't have a leader today because Zardari, who's been the president, can't lead because you can't be president and lead the party. And his son is some 22-year-old who is apparently, according to at least some press stories, nervous about being killed. Perhaps quite rightly, and isn't, you know, taking the reins and is feuding with his father. So you've got a PPP that's essentially destroyed. You've got the PMLN led by Nawaz Sharif. He has already been prime minister. He was moved off in a coup by Musharraf, who I'm sure most people will remember. But it looks most likely that his party will win. They've been in the opposition for 5 years. He's a very strong leader. And then you have the wild card, which is Imran Khan. He's actually been leading his party for over a decade. In fact, I think close to 2 decades now. And really was making no kind of imprint in politics in Pakistan until the last 2 or 3 years, and has really transformed and shaken things up, which is quite exciting. But the way that they have an interesting system of getting seats, much like the American one, where you can actually win a lot of votes and not end up with a lot of seats. So most people say that, you know, they might get votes, but it's unlikely they'll get seats. But nevertheless, a wild card.
Well, Zania, we will obviously be keeping close watch on events in Pakistan as they unfold ahead of the elections on Saturday.
Indeed.
Let's move to Chinese and Indian relations.
Again, this is an interesting one. It has appeared in the American papers, little bits and pieces, but the last really 3 weeks in middle of April, the Chinese military moved forward and kind of led an incursion, small incursion, into what most people consider to be Indian land in Ladakh, in the northwest. Now, it is disputed land. It has been disputed for quite a long time. But the Chinese don't seem to normally do this there. They do elsewhere along the border. Anyway, of course, you know, the Indians responded. You have face-off along the line of control there. And I was just in India end of last week, and a lot of people sitting there kind of saying, how do we roll this one back, with the Indian government not really wanting to take any big steps? Well, over the weekend, the Indians and the Chinese have decided to roll it back, which is meaning that the foreign minister's visit later this week from India to China will take place, and the Chinese premier's first overseas visit to India at the end of this month will take place. But it's a really interesting, I mean, quite apart from the incursion, small incursion, incursions happen all the time. Normally they don't make the media. This is a really interesting one, A, because the Chinese change in leadership end of last year. So just trying to learn a little bit more about how they're dealing with it and what kind of actions they're taking. But also the Chinese-Indian relationship and how that's kind of being managed despite border differences. Both sides really need economic development. That's their focus. So they're not willing to risk anything. It's kind of it's a sign of where, at least in a small way, economics seems to be trumping geopolitics.
Reading up on this just before we went on air, it was interesting to look in the Indian media. Not surprisingly, this being portrayed very much as a victory for India. The fact that China had I suppose it's not surprising in a way that the Hindustan Times and the Times of India would portray this as a victory for India, but not much in the Chinese press. And do you think it was a victory for India in the sense that China had to back down and withdraw from their position?
I don't think it was a victory for either side. I mean, this is, to me, in some respects, this is just testing. And what I was hearing in Delhi end of last week was exactly that this is the Chinese testing how far they can go, trying to figure out what they can get easily without great cost. And that's what this is. You know, it's forward, backwards. So, but it's nevertheless both sides testing one another.
Well, should we come back closer to the West with Syria and Obama?
Yes, I mean, here's, again, another interesting one. It's so much easier talking about politics than actually doing it. You know, Obama's in a really tight squeeze. You've got, on the one hand, you know, Obama's red line about using chemical weapons, which the Assad regime seems to have crossed over. On the other hand, you now have Carla Del Ponte on a UN tribunal saying, well, actually, maybe it's the opposition. Perhaps not the Free Syrian Army, but nevertheless the rebels who have been using some chemical weapons as well. I don't think instead of, but as well. And of course, over the last few days, you've had the Israelis bombing what they're saying are weapons depots, weapons that would go to Hezbollah otherwise, weapons depots in Damascus. I think it was Damascus. And so, you know, you've got this kind of Obama still trying to essentially what appears to be move forward on a political strategy. And Secretary Kerry is off to Russia this week to talk to Putin about whether they can find some way to manage the Syrian crisis and find a political solution. And you have an awful lot of events that are conspiring to prevent this from going down a political path.
What are Obama's options at the moment? I mean, there's a few different theories being put forward in different publications. You know, he could arm the moderate rebels, but again, who are those rebels? They seem to have, there's been a bit of an about turn in terms of just who we interpret the rebels to be.
Yeah. I mean, here's an interesting one. I mean, from the perspective of Obama, he's looking, I think, to the long term, which is how do you actually create a long-term solution rather than a short-term solution? A long-term solution is political, almost by its very nature. You have to bring people together. If that's the case, then you don't want to take any step that is going to prevent any kind of political agreement coming down later down the road. So he's trying very hard, I think, to not do something like arm the rebels, who, as you rightly point out, you don't quite know who they are anyway. Trying very hard not to arm the rebels in a way that would create more friction rather than less.
Well, Zenia Dormandy, many thanks as always for bringing us up to speed.
Coming up, Mohamed Morsi, the president of Egypt, kicks off 2 days in Brazil. Is that some light relief from the recent dramas in Egypt, or is he branching out his economic operation? We'll find out right after this.
Istanbul is at the crossroads of Europe and Asia, and Monocle 24 is heading there for two very special shows. On Tuesday, May 7 and Wednesday, May 8, we'll be broadcasting live from the rooftop of the George Hotel in the company of some of Turkey's most influential leaders. Mark your calendars and tune into The Globalist on May 7 and May 8. That's at 8 a.m. Istanbul time, 6 a.m. here in London, and 1400 hours in Tokyo. The Globalist, live from Istanbul, in association with GE.
Welcome back to Midori House. Now, despite meagre fluctuations, the overarching narrative of Brazil is a story of growth, and growth at an extremely impressive rate. Now regarded by the World Bank and the UN to be the world's sixth biggest economy, supplanting the UK, Brazil is a nation on the economic and political map, courted by visitors keen to learn lessons from its success and have their own share of it too.
Well, the embattled president of Egypt, Mohamed Morsi, thought he'd take a break from running his country and do just that, pay heed to those great guns of Brazil and strengthen his own nation's economic ties with the emerging giant of Latin America. He begins a two-day tour today. Well, Abdel Rahman Hussein, our man in Cairo, joins us on the line, as does Tiago Aragao, who's a senior research associate at the Foreign Policy Center based in Brasilia. A very good morning to you both. Let's begin in Cairo. And Abdel Rahman, of course, Morsi was in Russia and India in recent weeks. He's doing a bit of a BRIC tour. What's he hoping to achieve this time in Brazil?
Well, it's his last throw of the dice regarding his so far unfruitful attempt to wrestle investments from the BRICS country. As you've said, he's already been to Russia, India, and China and South Africa, and he's had very little to show for it. And so he's hoping the final list or might be more forthcoming regarding investments in Egypt.
And how likely do you think it is that he's going to have a different reception in Brazil, Abdul?
It's hard to say at the moment, but I mean, with the IMF loan still on hold and investments from Gulf countries not so forthcoming, Morsi had hoped the BRICS would offer an alternative to help Egypt's deteriorating economic situation.
Mm. Should we just quickly cross to Brasilia and bring Tiago Aragao into the conversation? Tiago, how much interest is there really in Brazil in a visit by Mohamed Morsi? Do you think it's just a bit more one way, and that perhaps this visit is a bit more, there's a bit more in it for Egypt than there is for Brazil?
Oh, of course, there is some interest in Brazil's side, alongside curiosity as well. Brazil aims at having a more clear protagonism in certain areas of the world, especially among the Arab countries. So I believe that Brazil's main goal with this is not only to open a new target for commercial relationships, but also to develop a relationship with a major key country in political affairs in the region, to have another entrance door to become a global player and not only a regional player in key political issues.
Abdul, I want to come back to you and ask, following Morsi's trip to Russia, where there was a slight sort of red face, he asked for a lot and didn't get much in return. How is that to his trip to Brazil being reported in the Egyptian press following that?
There's already a volume of trade between Egypt and Brazil. It amounts to about $3 billion a year. But it's weighed heavily in Brazil's favor, where Egyptian exports to Brazil are only 10% of that. So he's hoping to kind of boost the numbers in Egypt's favor. I mean, Egypt's facing a dire economic situation. It's in no small to the Muslim Brotherhood's extrajudicial maneuverings. And so he's desperately looking for revenue.
Tiago, do you think Brazil is likely to be at all generous in terms of its spirit towards Egypt? After all, Egypt's been shopping around for aid, well, not shopping around, but looking for aid around the world. And Qatar and the United States, of course, are generous benefactors. Could we see Brazil being generous in that sense too?
Absolutely, because we can see a trend in Brazilian behavior in terms of accessibility to credit to other countries in the region as well. Syria, for example, is a key country in which Brazil, before the beginning of the civil conflict, was a country that received some support from Brazil in terms of projects. So we can see that it would not be something new for Brazil to initiate cooperation with Egypt, as Brazil already have done so with other countries of the region, but as Lebanon for itself.
Well, Tiago Aragao in Brasilia there, and Abdulrahman Hussein in Cairo. Many thanks to both of you for your time.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo
to Shanghai
to Buenos Aires
to Hong Kong
to Berlin,
to Tel Aviv,
to Toronto,
to Amsterdam,
to Zurich.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
21 minutes past 8 in the morning here in London. We're going to turn now to the story of the bumblebee. It's a tale that crisscrosses the globe with a fairly significant amount of drama to boot. It begins in Kent. Once commonly found in the marshes of southern England, the short-haired bumblebee is now to be found thriving in New Zealand after the ancestors of today's bumblebee were shipped there in the 19th century.
It's the depletion of the bumblebee population in its native land, the UK, that has sparked the concern of many a conservationist. And one such interested party has put pen to paper and is calling on us all to take action. David Goulson, author of new book Sting in the Tail and founder of the Bumblebee Conservation Trust, told our producer, Alid John, why it was such an important book to write.
For me, the kind of motivation was to really try and make as many people as possible aware of the fact that much of our wildlife is still declining. And then it's, I don't want this to sound all doom and gloom, because the book isn't, but we really need to do something about it. And it worries me that people are more and more detached from natural history, from going out into the countryside and appreciating wildlife, and that because of that they may be kind of entirely unaware that things are slowly disappearing, and what a shame that is. And also the potential kind of knock-on effects for ourselves, you know, our well-being depends upon a myriad of creatures of various sizes and shapes, and we really need to look after them.
In your book you depict some of the, as you say, the knock-on effects. Could you perhaps paint a picture to what extent the depletion of the bumblebee will affect us as a human race? Obviously, the difficulty of these sorts of stories is making them relevant to people who will then bear them in mind.
Absolutely. I think the beauty of bees is that it's really easy to explain the link between the bee and our own, the benefits we get from them. It's much harder for some other types of wildlife, although the link may still be there. But for bees, essentially, about three-quarters of all the crops grown in the world are pollinated by insects, usually bees. And that actually comprises a rather smaller proportion of all the food we eat. It's about a third. And the reason for that difference is because the bulk of what we eat comes from wind-pollinated cereals, wheat, barley, and so on, and rice. But all the interesting stuff we eat, you think of all the fruit and veg, blueberries, strawberries, runner beans, field beans, peas, courgettes, tomatoes, I could go on for ages.
All the good stuff.
All the really nice stuff that when you sit down for a meal, that, you know, the stuff that makes it tasty, is pretty much all pollinated by bees. So, for example, tomatoes are more or less exclusively pollinated by bumblebees specifically. So every tomato you eat and every bottle of tomato ketchup that you use and so on, it's all based on the work of bumblebees. So without those bees, you know, our lives would be immeasurably more rubbish, to be honest. I really wouldn't fancy a diet of porridge and rice, and that's what we'd be looking at.
Is there a real sense that the depletion of the noble bumblebee is going to affect us within our lifetimes?
There's certainly evidence that basically shortages of pollinators more broadly, you know, bumblebees and honeybees and other insects that pollinate, they are declining, and there's evidence from parts of the world that that's reaching a kind of critical point whereby crop yields are beginning to suffer because there simply aren't enough insects to go around all the flowers anymore. In fact, there's some extreme examples. So in parts of China and parts of Brazil, they now have to hand pollinate their crops. So I've seen these amazing pictures from Sichuan where they have huge apple and pear orchards which they've blitzed with pesticides. And they've essentially eradicated insects completely from big chunks of countryside. And because of that, when the trees flower, there are no insects to pollinate them. So literally the farmers and their children have to climb into the trees and they have to hand pollinate every single flower with paintbrushes, which is just about possible in China where they've got lots of labor and it's a high-value crop. But for most crops in Europe, imagine a farmer trying to hand pollinate his oilseed rape field. It's not going to happen. So there are these examples already of where there's a complete crisis. The pollinators have basically been wiped out. And the real danger is that those areas are going to spread. And before long, we'll all be having to hand pollinate our fruit and veg and so on, which would be a disaster because bees are infinitely more efficient at pollinating flowers than people.
Without putting you on the spot then, Dave, can you see a way that we can prevent the recent depletion in the population of the bumblebee?
Yeah, it's quite straightforward in some senses. And there are a number of things we can easily do. I was quite pleased to see this recent ban on a particular type of pesticides came through, which I think is pretty good evidence have probably been contributing to bee declines. But the bigger picture is that bees have been declining for 50, 60 years, basically because these days, most farmland has almost no flowers in it at all. Modern agriculture doesn't really leave any room for weeds, doesn't really leave room for flowers growing in field margins. And so really, there's no food for most bees for most of the year living out in the wider countryside in much of Britain and Europe. But we can change that. It's perfectly possible to, and there are agri-environment schemes available to farmers encouraging them to put in flower strips along the side of their fields, for example. It's just a case of getting more people to do that, essentially just to slightly change the way we farm, to leave a bit of room for flowers and for bees and for all the other wildlife.
Glancing through the pages of your book, you've got some really great titles to some of the chapters. You've got the hot-blooded bee, you've got the short-haired bee, the bumblebee sniffer dogs. How much fun was it putting this book together? I know the sort of broader narrative is actually quite serious, but in terms of the work you must have put in to put this book together, and it's a very good-looking book, it must have been quite good fun as well, no?
I love working with bees generally. I mean, what I've been saying so far may sound a bit depressing, but actually they're just really cool and interesting beasts, and there are loads of aspects to their biology that we don't really understand very well, and some little bits of it we've managed to discover in the last 20 years, but there's plenty more to keep me going. So one of the big problems with bumblebees is finding the nests. They're really well hidden, tucked away underground, usually down a mouse hole or whatever in the bottom of a hedge. So we've had the army-trained sniffer dogs to find them. And we spent about 4 or 5 years with a succession of sniffer dogs and sniffer dog handlers out in the countryside finding bumblebee nests and using that as a way of studying them. It's all been heaps of fun. And, you know, they're absolutely amazing creatures and surprisingly intelligent and capable of all sorts of pretty impressive feats that I don't think until recently we really appreciated.
It's a really interesting story, including kind of the drama of the difficulty of trying to maintain the bee population, also sort of admiring the kind of the interesting habits of the bee and being so impressed at the sort of workforce that they entail. But then similarly, your book is titled A Sting in the Tail. I'm interested to know, is there a sting in the narrative? Is the sting the kind of, if we don't act now, there will be a very, very serious sting in the tail for us?
It is essentially that, yeah. It's not terribly obscure or profound. It's simply that these are amazing, interesting creatures, and also they're incredibly valuable to us. You know, they deliver for free to us this service of pollinating all of our crops, and we really need to learn to appreciate them and look after them.
And that was David Goulson, the author of the new book, Sting in the Tail, talking to our producer, Alan John, about the plights of the humble bumblebee, and we've been talking so much about bees in the press, haven't we?
We have.
It's been very topical.
Indeed. And we're going to be talking about stings of a different kind in the next half hour of Midori House. We'll be visiting Hong Kong's most famous tattoo artist. But first, I think it's Barney Burnham with the news headlines.
Thanks, Hugo. Three women who'd been missing for 9, 10 and 13 years respectively have been found alive and well in a house in Ohio. They're believed to have been abducted as teenagers and were found near where they were last seen in Cleveland. They've been taken to hospital and reported to be in good health. At least one of them is reported to have had a baby. Three brothers, all in their 50s, have been arrested. North Korea has begun moving missiles away from a launch site on the country's east coast. The move's being seen as the first sign of an easing of tension on the Korean Peninsula. Syria's opposition national coordination body has condemned the Israeli raids on Damascus suburbs and accused Israel of using Syria's internal conflict for its own political ends. Israel insists the attacks were nothing to do with the Syrian conflict and were targeting Iranian missiles which are on their way to Hezbollah militants. The World Health Organization is warning that outbreaks of measles are threatening Europe's commitment to eliminate the disease by 2015. The WHO says levels of vaccination in rich Western countries are too low, and catch-up campaigns like the one launched in Britain are needed across the continent. The Democratic Republic of Congo is the toughest place on earth to be a mother and newborn baby, according to a new report by the charity Save the Children. Sweden, Norway and Finland came top of the State of the World's Mothers 2013 report. And two bottles of Scotch whisky recovered from a 1941 shipwreck which inspired the novel and film Whisky Galore have sold in an online auction in Glasgow for £12,050. But they're thought to be unfit for human consumption. Those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Varney. You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24, live from London, where the time is 8:31.
We're going to head now to a central Paris address, which for a century and a half has been iconic for a couple of reasons. Number 7, Rue du Bourg l'Abbé in the 3rd arrondissement, first opened its doors in 1885 as a high-end bain-douche, or a public bathhouse, which was then transformed in the late 1970s into the legendary nightclub Les Bains, which was considered in its heyday to be one of the world's hottest night spots, and it regularly hosted the glitterati of the day.
But the venue was suddenly shut down in 2010 after being declared structurally hazardous. Tom, normally in Paris for us, went along to find out what's next for this much-loved building for this week's edition of Section D.
The sound of the latest chapter being carved out for what was the public bathhouse where Marcel Proust used to wash himself, the Paris nightclub where Grace Jones, Robert De Niro, Andy Warhol all strutted their stuff whenever they came to town, and which as of next year will be a smart new hotel on the edge of the Marais. I'm going to go inside Les Bains Douches now and meet one of the men whose job these next 12 months is to make this, the building's third major transformation, actually happen.
I'm Jean-Luc Horrube and I work with Jean-Pierre Marois, who is the owner of Les Bains. And I work with him on this project. The project is to make an hotel and a restaurant at the place where the Bain Douche was during 30 years old nightclub, who everybody know in the world. And we need to, we would like to make a new address. But not a new place, because the place is here, but a new address with a new guest and a real atmosphere for people who love Paris.
What are you going to keep in terms of the old features of the Bain Douche in the new project?
The name. The name and maybe as a spirit, but nothing more.
And what's the concept of the hotel exactly?
At this time, we don't know exactly, but we think and we hope that the new architect who makes the rooms and the hotel project made a very, very sensitive rooms with art, of course, and where we'd like to stay 3 or 4 nights.
Okay, and why do you think this building is so historic and so important in Paris?
Because first, as the building was built in 1885, and it's a very historical building, and during a long time was Les Bains Douches, so it was for people who work near from here, from Les Halles, and they want to come here to be distressed, but to take some coffee or chocolate and to have some good time after a very hard night work. And also during 25-30 years, it was the high hot spot for the show business and for people who want to make fiesta in Paris.
And when will the project all be finished?
Maybe in September 2014.
So that's what's next for this building, from bathhouse to nightclub to hotel. But just before undergoing that transformation into a hotel, the building's owner, Jean-Pierre Marois, lent these 3,000 square meters to urban artists for a few months for them to live and create murals and installations, and also to experiment to their heart's content throughout this rather creaky building's seven floors. And their works have been photographed and they'll soon be exhibited at a Paris gallery. Well, I'm going to make my way down this rather windy wooden staircase to what remains of the dance floor, where I'm going to meet Clémence Wolfe, who's been helping out with that temporary gallery project. What is so significant, Clémence, about this floor that we're on now?
The floor was made by Philippe Stack. It was his first private command. It was very strange at this time, because in the late 70s, nightclubs were more like fluo and with a lot of lights and like disco style. And Philippe Stack arrived and made this black and white, very sober floor for the discotheque.
It doesn't look either very 70s or very modern, really. It could be from the original baths.
Exactly, it doesn't look like a disco or anything related to the 70s or 80s, but a very designed floor.
So we're now with what was the entrance to the baths, then the nightclub, and soon next year to be the hotel. And it's a rather haunting scene, grandeur covered in dust and all boarded up all over the place with these bits of art and graffiti that the artists who did their installations have left behind. It's quite a haunting scene, isn't it, for those of us who remember the nightclub?
Yes, it was the place where all the people had their memories here. And because we entered the place by the kitchen, the place which used to be the kitchen, it was when they arrived there, they said, oh, I remember, it was the nightclub, because it's the entrance. And on her right, it was the cloakroom. And it was really the place they have in memories.
Okay, we're now standing at what was once the swimming pool of the baths, a place I guess you could cool down. And it was also once a VIP room of a nightclub in its sort of 70s, 80s heyday.
Yeah, as an example, it was the place where Prince had his table when he came to the bain douche. And Thierry Ardisson used to have a TV show just in front of this swimming pool. So it's the myth and the symbol of the nightclub.
Okay, so we've come to the end of our tour now. Thank you very much, Clémence, for showing me around. It's a rather sad day, I guess, for you as well, now that this place is closing its sort of middle life in between the nightclub and the hotel phase.
Yeah, but we'll soon have a book and all the picture as a memory of this special project with this amazing artist. We will have an exhibition at the gallery in Paris. So Magdalene's gallery, the exhibition will start on June the 15th with the pictures of this project and special installation by Vils, Eyes, Latlas and Stenlex. So we will be able to enjoy it for a long time.
And that was me in my normal stomping ground, the French capital, for this week's Section D, which you can catch at 1900 London time this evening. Well, we're going to continue our part two of our series of Hong Kong culture. We're going to be heading to the island's most celebrated tattoo artist in just a moment. But before we do that, here's Endless Flight by Kyoto Jazz Massive. Da 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 da
Kyoto Jazz Massive with Endless Flight there. You're listening to Midori House live from London.
Switzerland is the natural home of timekeeping and host to Baselworld, the most important international platform for the business of watchmaking. Monocle dispatched a film crew to investigate this year's innovation.
Baselworld attracts everybody from every tiny niche of the watch industry as a whole, and that can be somebody who buys components, somebody who sells completed watches, somebody who sells watch cases, somebody who writes about watches, and you can't really miss it.
Horological showmanship at the Basel Fairground. Check out our film on monocle.com.
Welcome back to Midori House. The time is 8:44 in London. That's 15:44 in Hong Kong.
Now, calligraphy is known throughout Asian cultures as the art of brush writing. And for thousands of years, the practice of calligraphy has always been a matter of putting brush to paper. But the art form has been undergoing a bit of a transformation in recent years, and some artists in Hong Kong are starting to put the needle to the skin or a tattoo machine gun in order to do Chinese calligraphy on the human body.
Well, in part two of our Asia Culture series, our researcher Alex Liu went along to talk to the founder of Tattoo Temple in Hong Kong, Joey Pang, to have a listen to how she put the old wine into a new bottle.
As an old Chinese saying goes, calligraphy is a reflection of one's personality. But with the extensive use of romanized input methods in China today, young Chinese increasingly forget how to write Chinese characters, let alone have beautiful penmanship, when most calligraphy artists still pondering how to save the form of art from dying. Someone in Hong Kong has already found a better way to go. Joey Pang, the founder of the Tattoo Temple Studio, is one of the pioneers of translating the traditional art form into tattooing. Not just a symbol of a tropical holiday, and not just your name in Chinese characters. Joey designs unique work for every client, with her fine sense of Chinese aesthetics, which makes her works stand out from the majority.
Hi, my name is Joey Pang. I'm a tattoo artist. I loved drawing since I was a kid, so I was always looking for jobs that related to drawings. I was trying makeup before, and then from makeup I found body art, body painting. And then from there, I was a bit upset about my drawing on the body is not permanent, like they will have to wash it off like after the day. Since then, I got the feelings that I want to stay. One time I was in New Zealand, I saw Maori tattoo, they're so beautiful, they totally have a different feeling, and it's their own culture, and it was different to the feelings that in Hong Kong that people thought tattoo is bad and like for gangster. Like, it was very positive in New Zealand, and that's how I start thinking it's possible to use tattoo as an art form, like drawing media to express myself. Actually, I start learning the Chinese calligraphy and paintings after tattoo, because in Europe I found that people love tattoo the Chinese characters a lot, and they are really bad because they sell the character like picture, so that means they don't know how to write it at all. And so I have a feeling that this is like a mission for Chinese, that I have to introduce the proper Chinese art to people or to the world. If they like it, then yeah, they need to see the real art.
When talking about Asian tattoo style, Japanese traditional tattooing, that colorful painting covers the entire body. If you're looking for an Asian style tattoo, aside from putting on a Japanese exaggerated full body suit, which might make you feel like a gangster, Joey's Chinese approach might be an alternative for those who prefer low profile self-expression.
What I do is completely opposite to how people usually see tattoo, like from the very bold color old school to very soft hand touch brush, from the full body suit Japanese tattoo to the Chinese style is like the space is same important in the drawing. So you have a breathing space. When you look at the body, you don't feel so tight. The tattoo just like come from your body. It's like part of your body. It's not like a cover your body. In the traditional Japanese tattoo, the concept is like a bodysuit. I think everybody heard about it. Even it's not the whole body, it's still like a sleeve, like you cover part of your arm and your leg, and you have to feel for every inch of the skin. But then in Chinese paintings, there's only two styles. One is the ink abstract style, and other is more details. Actually, this part, not many people knows about it. The details one could be feel full like Japanese tattoo, but they use lighter, more see-through color. And still the space, the elements arranged is not necessarily filled. I would say you cannot fill in all the space. You have to leave the space to breathe.
Gone are the days when wearing a tattoo drew stares and looks of disdain. Even in the most conservative societies in Asia, tattoos are becoming more accepted at work. Indeed, many well-educated professionals have become Joey's loyal customers who don't mind waiting for 2 years to get a perfect piece on their body.
My name is Chris Anderson. I'm from Hong Kong. I pretty much have full upper body tattoos, both my arms and chest. I've got tribal style on one side and then very traditional Chinese ghetto style on the other side. I couldn't really say why I got them. I guess it just appealed to me. I went to a very local traditional Chinese artist to get it all done. So it was quite an experience even going into his studio and talking to him and deciding on the work.
My name is Elizabeth and I'm from Hong Kong and I have several tattoos and they are like pretty much like, you know, just really small. And they're like, I'll say it's a symbol or something. The initial idea of getting them is because of, I just like the shape of it. It doesn't really have much meaning to me, but I still love them. Yeah, and to me, tattoo is just like an art form. It doesn't have to be, you know, have certain meaning when you get it.
For those who are eager to give it a go, here's some advice from Joey.
First of all, they need to know what they want because the tattoo represents themselves. And cannot be rushed because once you get it, it stays with you forever. And so it's no point to rush to get whatever tattoo you can get. Just be sure you have a feeling with the artist and you have to work with him to create the artwork together.
Let's all go to Hong Kong and get tattoos. You can hear part three of our series on Asian culture on tomorrow's Midori House, where we explore the Hong Kong film scene.
Almost time for our daily monologue, but just before that, let's have a bit of music. And here's the Canadian duo Tegan and Sarah with one of their Midori House session specials. This is Back in Your Head.
Build a wall of books between us and my bed. Repeat the words that I know we both said. Relax into the knee, we get so comfortable. Remember when I was so stranger like a bull. Away from holding hands with you. Well, I know these habits hurt important parts of you. Remember when I was sweet and unexplainable. I'm nothing like the
And that was Tegan and Sarah with Back in Your Head, recorded in this very building.
Well, we're fast approaching the end of the show, but before we go, there's just enough time for today's monologue. Our managing editor, David Michon, extols the virtues of fixing your own bike.
In London, commuting is often quickest on two wheels. Getting from my flat just east of central London to Midori House just west of it can take up to 45 minutes in a taxi during rush hour, or 35 minutes on the tube. Taking things into my own hands on a bicycle cuts that down to just 25. And though London streets are full of perils, be it cobblestones or careening double-deckers, my biggest stress as a cyclist isn't anything so obvious. That honour goes to the city's bicycle repairmen. Few others in London's service industry can be as disdainful and pretentious as the 30-something cycle shop attendant, which says quite a lot in a city not known for being cheerful. From the moment you awkwardly negotiate your bike through the shop's front door, unassisted, your presence is quite regularly treated as an imposition, rather than that which keeps their business afloat. Who is it they were expecting to walk in? So as spring has finally shown its face in the city, it has also come time for me to fix a flat tire after months of weather-related excuses that had me opting for the underground. But instead of facing the ranks of holier-than-thou part-time chain tweakers, I wheeled my sick cycle to the London Bike Kitchen, a small little shop just off Regent's Canal at the top of Hoxton Street. Founded by Jenny Gwizdowski over a year ago, the London Bike Kitchen takes a do-it-yourself approach. Turn up with a problem, and they'll instruct you on how to fix it yourself and give you the tools to do it. Jenny hails from California, where the DIY culture has already taken root. But she fell in love with cycling while living in Japan, having been given a bike by her work as a means to commute. Now in London, she was quite surprised how quickly this city's cyclists were opting to hand off their repairs and pay hefty fees for what could be done simply for almost no cost. More importantly, she says that being DIY shy has hindered London's cycle culture from being as quality of life contributing as it has in Japan. Admitting that you can't change an inner tube after commuting to and from university or work for over a decade would incite deep sighs and eye rolls at most bike shops I frequented. But Jenny's attitude is collegial and congenial. Why? Her interest isn't commercial, but in building a better cycle culture. However easy it is to romanticize a leisurely weekend of park and pub crawling on a Dutch bike, the realities of daily commuting can be stressful, and the last thing one needs is to be scoffed at in your time of need. What DIY and the London Bike Kitchen offer is to help make cycling more enjoyable, ditching the inevitable subpar service and making two-wheeled treks across town that much more liberating. For Monocle, I'm David Michon.
And that was David Michon there. And that, I'm afraid, is all we have time for. Thank you very much to our producer today, Alan John. Our researchers were Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Audrey Lettendal, Barbara Feeney, and our studio manager was Chris Fitch. Up next, after the news, is the latest episode of The Entrepreneurs, our weekly business show hosted by Sophie Grove.
Tom, you'll be back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow, joined in the hot seat, not by me, but by Monocle's foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield. But from us, for now, today, thank you very much for listening.
Thank you.
Goodbye.
Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.